red, and then stood back.
Corjet, thank you.
As soon as my father spoke the words, they bowed and went back to the kitchen. I stared at him in consternation.
I hired more staff, B. It's time we did things a bit more properly here. You'll soon get to know them and be comfortable with them. They are cousins to Tavia's husband, and highly recommended.
I nodded, but I still felt unhappy about it. The meal went in stages, and my father was careful to speak to Riddle and to Shun, as if conversation was something he had to share evenly with everyone at the table. He asked Shun if her room suited her for now. She replied stiffly that it would be fine. He asked Riddle what he thought of the soup, and Riddle said it was as good as that served at Buckkeep Castle. Throughout the meal, he and Riddle spoke only of very ordinary topics. Did he think it would snow more tomorrow? My father hoped the snows would not be too deep this year. Riddle said it would be good if they were not too deep this year. Did Shun enjoy riding? There were some fine riding trails at Withy Woods, and my father thought her horse looked like a good one. Perhaps she would like to explore the estate of Withy Woods a bit tomorrow. Riddle asked if my father still had the grey mare he had used to ride. My father said that he did. Riddle asked if they might go look at her after dinner. He had been thinking of asking my father if she could carry a foal from a certain black stud at Buckkeep for him. It was such a transparent excuse for getting my father alone to talk to him that I almost couldn't stand it. After dinner, we went to a little room with comfortable chairs and a nice fire in the hearth. Riddle and my father left to walk out to the stables. Shun and I sat and looked at each other. Tavia came in with tea for us.
Chamomile and sweet breath, to ease you to sleep after your long travels today,
she said to Shun with a smile. Thank you, Tavia, I said after the silence had fallen and Shun had made no response to her.
You are very welcome, she replied.
She poured tea for each of us and left. I took my teacup from the tray and went and sat on the hearth. Shun looked down at me. Does he always let you stay awake and be with the adults? She obviously disapproved. Adults? I asked, looking around me. I smiled at her as if puzzled.
You should be in bed by now.
Why?
It's what is done with children in the evening. They go to bed so that adults can have conversations.
I thought about that, and then looked into the fire. Would my father start sending me to bed in the evening so that he and Shun could stay awake and talk? I took up the poker and hit the burning log with it firmly, sending up a shower of sparks. Then I hit it again.
Stop that! You'll make the fire smoke!
I hit it one more time, and then put the poker back. I didn't look at her.
I suppose it's well that you are not wearing skirts. You'd dirty them down there. Why are you sitting on the hearth instead of in a chair?
The chairs were too tall. My feet dangled. I looked at the newly swept bricks. It's not dirty here.
Why are you dressed like a boy?
I looked down at my tunic and leggings. I had a few spider webs on my ankle. I picked them free. I'm dressed comfortably. Do you like wearing all those layers of skirts? Shun flounced them out around herself. They were pretty, like the spread petals of a flower. The outer skirts were a blue, one shade lighter than Buckkeep blue. The petticoat beneath was an even lighter blue, and the lacy edge of it showed deliberately. It matched the pale blue of the bodice of her dress, and the lace was the same as the lace at her throat and cuffs. That dress and petticoat had not come from any crossroads market. They'd probably be made especially for her. She smoothed them with satisfaction. They're warm and very pretty. They were expensive, too. She lifted her hand and touched her earrings, as if I could have failed to notice them. So were these. Pearls from Germania. Lord Shade got them for me. I wore a simple tunic, sewn by my mother and made long enough to be modest, over a long-sleeved wool shirt. My tunic was belted at my waist with a leather belt and came to my knees. Below it, I wore only my woolen leggings and slippers. No one had ever suggested before that I was dressed like a boy, but now I recalled how the stable boys dressed. Not so different from me. Even the kitchen girls wore skirts all the time. I looked at the cuffs of my sleeves. They were soiled with cobwebs and chalk from my earlier adventure. The knees of my leggings were dirty too. I suddenly knew that my mother would have made me change my clothes before I came down to dinner with guests, into my red skirts perhaps. She would have put ribbons in my hair. I lifted my hand to my hair and smoothed down what was left of it. Shun nodded. That's a little better. It was standing up like feathers on a bird's head. It's too short to braid. I cut it because my mother died. I looked at her directly for one instant. Shun met my gaze coldly. Then she said, I can only wish my mother were dead. I think it would make my life easier. I stared at her knees. Her words cut me, and I tried to understand why. After a moment, it came to me. She considered her pain more significant than mine. I felt she had said that her cruel mother's life going on was a greater tragedy than my mother's death. In that moment, I hated her. But I also discovered another important thing. I could do as my father did. That is, lift my eyes and meet her gaze and let nothing of what I was thinking show in my face. That thought surprised me. I studied her, saying nothing, and realized that she did not share my ability. Everything she felt at the moment was writ broad and plain on her face. Perhaps she thought I was too young to read her face, or that it was unimportant if I could. But she was not trying to hide anything from me. She had known her callous words would hurt me. She was miserable and resented being in my home and was irritated by being left with me. And in her misery, she was striking out at me because I was there, and because she thought I could not strike back. I did not feel pity for her. She was too dangerous for me to pity. I suspected that in her thoughtless wretchedness, she could employ cruelty such as I had never experienced from an adult. I suddenly feared that she could destroy all of us and take whatever little peace my father and I had found. She sat there in her pretty clothes and pearl earrings and looked at me, so small and, she thought, very young and dirty and common. Of course. She thought me the daughter of Commoner Tom Badgerlock, not the lost princess of the Farseer family, just the daughter of Withywood's widowed caretaker. Yet I had a home and a father who loved me and memories of a mother who had cherished me. None of that seemed fair to her. You've gone quiet, she observed intently. She was like a bored cat poking at a mouse to see if it was dead all the way. It's late for me. I'm a child, you know. I go to bed quite early on most nights. I yawned for her, not covering my mouth. In a softer voice, I added, and self-pitying tales of woe always bore me, which makes me sleepy. She stared at me, her eyes going greener. She reached as if to tidy her hair and pulled out one of the long pins that secured it. She drew it between her thumb and forefinger as if to deliberately call my attention to it. Did she think to threaten me with it? She stood abruptly, and I jumped to my feet. I bet I could outrun her, but dodging past her to the door might be a challenge. I heard a murmur in the hall, and an instant later, Riddle opened the door. My father was behind him. Good night, I called cheerily to them. I ran past a glowering Shun to hug my father briefly and then stepped back hastily. It's been such a long day and so full of unexpected events. I'm quite weary. I think I shall take myself to bed now.
Well,
my father looked astonished.
If you're tired, shall I see you to your room? Yes,
Riddle said strongly before I could reply. Shun was tidying her hair, smiling as she slid the pin back into her bound tresses.
She didn't feel well earlier. You should see that she is tucked in warmly, and that a nice fire is on her hearth. Yes, I should,
he agreed. He was smiling and nodding, as if it were perfectly normal that I seek my bed at such an hour. Usually, we stayed up late together, and often I fell asleep on the hearth in his study. Now he begged his guests to excuse him briefly, promised to return, and then took my hand as we left. I did not pull it free of his grip until the door was closed behind us.
What are you up to?
He demanded as we made our way toward the stairs and my bedchamber. Nothing. It's night. I'm going to bed. It's what children do, I am told.
Shun's face was flushed.
I think she was sitting too close to the fire.
Bee?
My name was all he said, but there was rebuke in the word. I was silent. I did not feel I deserved it. Should I tell him of her hairpin? Doubtless he would think me silly. We reached my door, and I seized the door handle before he could. I want only to go to bed tonight. Doubtless you need to hurry back to talk to the other adults.
Bee!
He exclaimed, and now my name meant that I had struck him, hurting him, and also provoking a bit of anger. I didn't care. Let him go fuss over poor, pitiful Shun. She needed his sympathy, not me. His face went still.
Stay here while I check your room.
I did as he told me, waiting by the open door. But the moment he came out, I slipped in through the door and shut it behind me. I waited, holding on to the door handle to see if he would try to come in and talk to me. But he didn't. I knew he wouldn't. I walked across the room and put another log on the hearth fire. I wasn't sleepy. I peeled off my clothing, bunched it up and sniffed it. Not just dirty, but definitely a mousy smell to it, probably from the spy corridors. I thought of Stripey patrolling for rats and mice. I thought of stealthily leaving my room and going to my father's study to see if the cat wanted to come out yet. But I would have to get dressed again, and if my father caught me wandering the halls tonight, he would be angry. I'd get up very early, I decided. Both my winter nightshirts smelled a bit fusty. When my mother was alive, clothing always smelled like cedar and herbs, if taken right from the chest, or sunlight and lavender, if freshly washed. I had suspected that the household staff had become more lax about their chores since my mother's death, but this was the first time I had realized how directly it would affect me. I blamed my father. Then I blamed myself. How could I even begin to imagine that he could know these things? He probably had no idea that it had been weeks since I had bathed my whole body or washed my hair. True, it was winter, but my mother had always made me wash my whole body in a tub at least once a week, even in winter. I wondered if the extra servants he had hired would mean that things would go back to the way they had been. I rather thought not. I doubted they would until someone took the reins. Perhaps Shun? The thought made steel of my spine. No. Me. This was my household, really. I was the female here, standing in my sister's stead, in my sister's house. I imagined that the servants my father had always supervised were doing their work as they always had. Revel looked over his shoulder for those ones. But my mother had overseen the household staff. Revel was good at making things fancy, but I didn't think he supervised the daily washing up and dusting and tidying. I would have to step up to that now. I pulled on my least smelly nightshirt. I looked at my feet and used what water was left in my ewer to wash my face, hands, and feet. I built up my fire and clambered into my bed. There was so much to think about that I thought I would never be able to fall asleep. But I did, because I woke to the colorless girl standing over my bed. Ruby tears were on her cheeks. Pink blood was frothing on her lips. She stared at me.
The message,
she said, spitting blood with the words, and then she fell upon me. I shrieked and struggled out from under her. She clutched at me, but I was off the bed and heading for the door in less than a breath. I was screaming, but no sound was coming out. The door latch jiggled in my fumbling panic, and then it swung open, and I raced out into the dark hall. My bare feet slapped the floor, and I was making little shrieks now. What if my father's bedroom door was latched? What if he wasn't there, but down in his study, or somewhere else in the house? "Papa, Papa," I heard myself stuttering, but I could not get any volume from my voice. His door opened at my touch, and to my shock, he was on his feet, a knife in his hand before I could even reach his bed. He was barefoot, and his shirt was half open, as if he'd been getting ready for bed. He snatched me up in his free arm, then twisted his body so that I was almost behind him, and his knife menaced the open doorway. He spoke without taking his eyes from it.
"Are you hurt? What is it? Where?"
"My room. The girl." My teeth were chattering with such terror that I do not imagine I spoke clearly. He still seemed to understand. He dropped me almost gently to the floor and began to move.
"Behind me. Close behind me, Bee."
He didn't look back to see if I obeyed. He went, running, knife in hand, and I had to race after him, going back to the last place in the world I wished to be. With no knife in my hand. If I lived through tonight, I promised myself that that would never happen again. I'd steal a knife for myself from the kitchen and keep it under my pillow, I would. We reached my room, and he angrily gestured me away from the door. His lips were pulled back from his teeth, and his eyes were dark and wild. Wolffather was in them, and his anger was a killing anger that anything would threaten his cub. He halted at the threshold and stared into the room that was lit only by the dying flames of the hearth. His nostrils were flared, and he moved his head from side to side. Then he went very still. He advanced so slowly on the sprawled figure on my bed that it was as if only one small part of him moved at a time. He glanced at me.
"You defended yourself? You killed her?"
I shook my head. My throat was still dry with terror, but I managed to say, "I ran." A terse nod.
"Good."
He drew closer to my bed and stared down at her. He stiffened suddenly, lifting his knife to the ready, and I heard her wet whisper,
"The message. You must hear the message before I die."
His face changed.
"Bee, bring water."
There was only a bit left in my ewer. I went into the room where we had left her and found the tray with the untouched food. There was water for tea in a pot gone cold. I brought it to my father. He had arranged her on my bed.
"Drink a little,"
he urged her, and held the cup to her lips. She opened her mouth, but could not seem to swallow what she took. It ran out of her mouth and over her chin, washing the pink even paler.
"Where did you go?"
my father demanded of her.
"We could not find you."
Her eyes were open to slits. The lids looked dry and crusty.
"I was there, in the bed. Oh."
She suddenly looked even sadder.
"Oh, the cloak. It was the cloak. I was cold and pulled the cloak over me. It vanished me."
I had ventured closer to the bed. I did not think she was aware of me. I thought perhaps she was blind now. My father and I exchanged skeptical looks. She moved her hand in a vague gesture. It reminded me of a slender willow leaf moving in the wind.
"It takes on the colors and shadows. Don't lose it. Very old, you know."
Her chest rose slowly and then fell. She was so still, I thought she was dead. Then she cried out as if pained by the words.
The message.
I'm here. I'm listening.
My father took her narrow hand in his.
Too warm.
He murmured.
Much too warm.
So hard to think. To focus. He made it a pattern. Easier to remember. Not safe to write it down.
I understand.
She sniffed in a breath. When she breathed out, little pink bubbles formed along her lips. I didn't want to look at them, and couldn't look away.
By four things, you will know I am a true messenger from him, and trust me. Ratsy was on his scepter. Your mother's name was never said. You served a man behind a wall. He took his fingerprints from your wrist.
She paused, breathing. We waited. I saw her swallow, and she turned her face toward my father.
Satisfied?
She asked him faintly.
That I am a true messenger.
I was right. She could not see his face. He jerked as if stuck with a pin.
Yes, yes, of course, I trust you. Are you hungry? Do you think you could drink some warmed milk or eat something?
He closed his eyes for a moment and went very still.
We would never have neglected you so if we had known you were still here. When we could not find you, we thought you had felt well enough to travel and left us.
He did not mention that we had wondered if she was hiding somewhere in the house, hoping to kill us. Her breath made a sound on every intake.
No. No food. Too late for food.
She tried to clear her throat, and the spill of blood on her lips went redder.
Not time to think of me. The message.
I can still send for a healer.
The message,
she insisted.
The message. And then you can do whatever you wish.
The message, then.
My father capitulated.
I'm listening. Go on.
She strangled for a moment, and then pink slid over her lip and down her chin. My father wiped it tenderly away with the corner of my blanket. I decided I would sleep in his bed tonight. When she could, she took in air and said on a breath,
He told you. The old dream prophecies foretold the unexpected son. The one who sent me once interpreted them to mean you. But now he thinks, perhaps not. He believes there could be another one. A son, unlooked for and unexpected. A boy left somewhere along the way. He does not know where, or when, or who mothered him. But he hopes you can find him before the hunters do.
She ran out of breath. She coughed and spluttered out blood and spit. She closed her eyes and for a time just tried to breathe.
The fool had a son?
My father was incredulous. She gave a short, sharp nod. Then she shook her head.
His and yet not his. A half-blood white. But it's possible he appears as a full white, like me.
Her breathing steadied for a time, and I thought she had finished. Then she took a deeper breath.
You must search for him. When you find the unexpected son, you must keep him safe. Tell no one you have him. Speak of your quest to no one. It's the only way to keep him safe.
I'll find him.
My father promised. She smiled faintly, her teeth showing pink.
I'll send for a healer now.
My father said. But she moved her head in a feeble shake.
No, there's more. Water, please.
He held the cup to her mouth. She didn't drink, but sloshed the water in her mouth and let it run out over her chin. He wiped her face again.
Hunters will come. Acting friendly, maybe. Or in disguise. Making you believe they are friends.
She spoke in short bursts, breathing in between.
Trust the unexpected, son. To no one. Even if they say they have come for him. To take him where he belongs. Wait for the one who sent me. He will come for him, if he can. So he said, when he sent me. So long ago. Why did he not get here before me? I fear. No. I must believe that he still journey. He escaped, but they will hunt him. When he is able to, he will come. But slowly, he has to evade them. It will take him time, but he will get here. Until then, you must find him and keep him safe.
I was not certain she believed her own words.
Where should I look?
My father asked her urgently. She shook her head slightly.
I don't know. If he knew, he gave me no hints. So if they captured me and tortured me, I could not betray him.
She moved her head on the pillow, her blind eyes seeking for him.
Will you find him?
He took her hand and held it carefully.
I'll find his son and keep him safe until he gets here.
I wondered if he lied to make her feel better. Her eyes closed until only a pale grey moon showed under her lids.
Yes, so valuable. They will want him badly, enough to kill. If they take him.
Her brow wrinkled.
Like I was treated. A tool. No choices.
Her eyelids fluttered open, and her queer, colourless stare seemed to meet his gaze.
I've borne 3 children. Never seen or held any. They take them, as they took me.
I don't understand.
My father said, but at her desperate look, he amended it to,
I understand enough. I will find him, and I will keep him safe. I promise. Now we will make you comfortable, and you will rest.
Burn my body,
she said insistently.
If it comes to that, I will. But for now,
it will come to that. My companion searched the wounds. I told you. What went in won't come out.
A poison?
She shook her head.
Eggs. They've hatched now. They're eating me.
She winced and coughed again.
Sorry. Burn bedding with me.
Her eyes opened and her blank gaze wandered over the room.
You should put me outside. They bite and burrow and lay eggs.
She coughed pink.
Punishment for traitor.
She blinked, and drops of red oozed from the corners of her eyes.
Treason is unforgivable, so punished with unstoppable death. Slow. It takes weeks.
She shuddered and then squirmed. She looked up at my father.
The pain is building. Again.
I can't see. They're eating my eyes. Are they bloody? I heard the sound of my father swallowing. He sank down beside the bed until his face was on a level with the girl's. A stillness had taken his face. I could not tell if he felt anything. He asked quietly,
Are you finished then? That was the whole message.
She nodded. She rolled her head to meet my father's gaze, but I knew she could not see him. Blood in ruby drops clung to her eyelashes.
I'm finished. Yes.
My father lurched to his feet. He turned as if he would run from the room. Instead, he snatched up the empty ewer. He spoke sternly.
Bee, I need cool, fresh water. And bring some vinegar in a cup and...
He paused to think.
Go to Patience's garden room. Bring me 2 double handfuls of the mint that grows closest to the statue of the girl with the sword. Go.
I took the ewer and a candle in a holder and went. The darkness made the corridors longer. The kitchen was a place of lurking shadows. The vinegar was in a large crock, and the containers to carry it all up out of my reach. I had to push benches and climb. I left the heavy ewer of water and the vinegar and threaded my way through the sleeping house to Patience's garden room. I found the mint and tore at the plants recklessly, filling a fold of my nightshirt with the aromatic leaves. Then I trotted back to the kitchen, candle in one hand and the other holding my hiked-up nightshirt with the mint. In the kitchen, I tied up the mint in a clean cloth and gripped the knot in my teeth. I abandoned my candle to clutch the heavy ewer in one arm and the vinegar in my other hand. I hurried as fast as I could, trying not to think of maggots eating me from the inside. By the time I reached the door of my room and set everything down to open the door, I was out of breath. I felt as if I had been running for the whole night. A horrifying sight met my eyes. My feather bed was on the floor. My father knelt beside it. He had his boots on, and his heavy cloak was on the floor beside him, so he must have gone back to his room. He had torn one of my coverlets into strips and was using them to tie the bundle he was making. His face was grey when he looked up at me.
"She died,"
he said.
"I'm taking her outside to burn her."
He had not paused in his feverish bundle-making. My feather bed was taking on the shape of an immense cocoon. There was a dead girl inside it. He looked away from me and added,
"Strip to the skin here, then go to my room. You can find one of my shirts to sleep in. Leave your nightshirt here. I'm going to burn it with her."
I stared at him. I set the ewer down and the vinegar. The bundled mint fell from my shirt to the floor as I let it drop. Whatever medicine he had intended to make, it was too late now. She was dead. Dead like my mother. He pushed another strip of blanket under the bundle, brought up both ends, and snugged it tight in a knot. My voice came out very little. "I'm not going naked through the corridors, and you can't do this all alone. Should I get Riddle to help you?"
"No."
He squatted back on his heels.
"Bee, come here."
I went to him. I thought he was going to hug me and tell me it would be all right. Instead, he had me bend my neck, and he looked all through my shorn hair. Then he rose, crossed to my clothing chest, and opened it. He took out last year's wool robe.
"I'm sorry,"
he said when he came back to me.
"But I have to keep you safe."
He took the hem of my nightshirt and stripped it off me. Then he looked at me, all over, under my arms and at my bottom and between the toes of my feet. We were both very red in the face before he was finished. Then he gave me the wool robe and took my nightshirt to add to his bundle.
"Pull on your boots and a winter cloak,"
he told me.
"You'll have to help me, and no one can ever know what we do tonight. No one can know the message she brought, or even that we found her again. If other people know, that child will be in greater danger. The boy she spoke about. Do you understand that?"
I nodded. In that moment, I missed my mother more than I ever had before.
Chapter 17. Assassins. There is, in all honesty, no way to kill someone mercifully. There are those who count it no crime to drown an imperfect newborn in warm water, as if the infant will not struggle desperately to draw air into its lungs. Did it not try to breathe, it would not drown. But they do not hear the screams, nor feel the darkening of the mind that the child endures, so they have been merciful to themselves. This is true of most mercy killings. The best an assassin can do is create a setting in which he does not have to witness the pain he causes. Ah, you will say, but what of drugs and poisons that send a man into a deep sleep from which he never emerges? Perhaps, but I doubt it. I suspect that some part of the victim knows. The body knows it is being murdered, and it keeps few secrets from the mind. The strangler, the suffocator, the exsanguinator may all claim that their victims did not suffer. They lie. All they may truly say is that the victim's suffering was invisible to them, and no one returns to say they were wrong. Murdoch's 279 Ways to Kill an Adult. As I carried her body down the stairs, my little darling trotted before me, bearing a candle to light my way. For one terrible moment, I felt grateful that Molly was dead and could not witness what I was demanding of our child. At least I had created a long enough diversion that she had not witnessed me killing the messenger. I had used the two blood points in her throat. When I first placed my hands, she had known what I was doing. Her blind and bloody gaze had met mine, and for a moment I read relief and permission on her face. But then, as I applied the pressure, she had reflexively reached up to seize my wrists. She had struggled, fighting for a few more moments of pain-riddled life. She was too weakened to put up much of a fight. She managed to scratch me a bit. It had been a long, long time since I had killed anyone. I'd never anticipated killing with arousal, as some assassins do. I'd never made it my joy, my fulfillment, or even my cherished goal. I'd accepted it as my task in life when I was very young, and I'd done it, efficiently and coldly, and tried not to think too much about it. That night, even with the messenger's initial permission, even with the knowledge that I was saving her from a lingering and painful death, was probably my worst experience as an assassin. And here I was, making my small daughter a party to it, and binding her to silence. Had I sought righteously to keep Shade and Ketricum from dragging her into being a farseer with all the attendant history, they certainly would not have exposed her to anything like this. I had been so proud of how long it had been since I'd killed anyone. Oh, good work, Fitz. Don't let them put the burdens of being a farseer on those thin shoulders. Make her an assassin's apprentice instead. On an estate like Withywood's, there is always, somewhere, a pile of brush and branches waiting to be burned. All end up heaped somewhere out of the way. Ours was at the far side of the lambing pens in a pasture. I carried the bundle messenger and led the way through the tall snowy grass in the winter night. Bee walked silently beside me. It was an unpleasant walk in the dark and wet. She followed in the trail I broke. We came to a snow-edged mound of brambly and twiggy branches, thorn bushes cut and thrown here, and fallen branches from the trees bordering the pasture that were too skinny to be worth cutting into firewood. It was an ample pile for my task. There I set down my load, and the bundled body tipped unevenly onto the pile. I pulled the branches over her and made the pile more compact. Bee watched. I thought perhaps I should send her back, tell her to go to my room and sleep. I knew she wouldn't, and suspected that actually witnessing what I had to do would be less horrific than imagining it. Together, we went to fetch oil and coals. She watched me fling the oil over the branches and pour it generously over the wrapped body. Then we set it alight. The evergreen branches and brambles were resinous. They caught fire quickly, and their flames dried the thicker branches. I fear they would consume themselves before the body was gone. But the oily featherbed caught and burned well with a harsh stink. I brought more branches to throw on our bonfire, and Bee helped. She was always a pale little creature, and the chill black night chalked her. The red firelight dancing on her face and shock of hair made her some strange little death sprite from an old tale. The pyre burned well, the flames reaching up higher than my head. Their light pushed the night back. Soon my face was uncomfortably warm and my back still cold. I braced myself against the heat to push the ends of branches in and to add more to the conflagration. The fire spoke, crackling and hissing, when I threw on a frost-laden branch. The flames ate our secret. Bee stood next to me, but not touching me, and we watched the messenger burn. It takes a long time to burn a body. Most of it we spent in silence. Bee had little to say other than, "What shall we tell the others?" I sorted my thoughts. To Shun, we say nothing of this. She believes the girl left. We will let Riddle believe the same. To the housekeeping staff, I will say that you complained of itchy bites, and I found vermin in your bed when I was putting you in it, and decided to burn it immediately. I gave a small sigh and admitted, "It won't be fair to them. I must pretend to be very upset with them. I will demand that every bit of your clothing be washed fresh, and new bedding brought for you." She gave a single nod. She turned her eyes back to the fire. I gathered another armful of branches and threw them onto the blaze. The half-burned limbs gave way under this fresh weight, crumpling down on the embered remains. The featherbed whispered away as downy ash. Were those blackened bones or blackened branches? Even I could not tell. The faint smell of roasting meat sickened me.
"You are very good at this. You have thought of everything."
Not a compliment I wanted to receive from my little daughter. I used to have to do special work. For the king, I learned to think of many things at once.
"And to lie very well. And not let people see what you are thinking."
That too. I'm not proud of it, Bee. But the secret that we heard tonight is not mine. It belongs to my very old friend. You heard what the messenger said. He has a son, and that son is in danger. Could she hear in my voice how peculiar I found this news? The fool had a son. I had never been absolutely certain of his masculinity, but if a child had been born, it must have come from a woman's womb. That meant that somewhere, that son had a mother. A woman whom, presumably, the fool had loved. I thought that I had known him better than any other person ever had, and yet this was something I never would have suspected. The woman would be my beginning point. Who was she? I racked my brains. Garetha came to mind. She had been a gardener's maid when the fool and I were children. Even then she had been enamored of him. As a youngster, he had been a lithe and playful fellow, turning handsprings and flips and doing the juggler's tricks expected of a jester. He had been quick-tongued. Often, his humor had been cruel to those he felt could be well served by being taken down a notch or two. With the very young, or those not treated kindly by fate, he had been gentler, often turning his jests back on himself. Garetha had not been pretty, and he had been kind to her. For some women, that is all it takes. In later years she had recalled him, recognized him in his guise of Lord Golden. Had there been more than recognition? Had that been how he had persuaded her to keep his secret? If they had had a child, the boy would be in his mid-twenties now. Was she the only possibility? Well, there were whores and ladies of pleasure in plenty in Buckkeep Town, but I could not imagine the fool frequenting them. It had to be Garetha. Then my thoughts stepped sideways, and I suddenly saw the fool in a different light. He had always been a very private person. He might have had a hidden lover, or a not-so-secret one.
Laurel.
The witted huntswoman had made no secret of her attraction to him. He had spent years away from Buck, in Bington, and possibly Jamalia. I knew next to nothing of his life there, save that he had lived in the guise of a woman. And then, the obvious fell into place, and I thought myself a great dunce. Jofrin. Why had he written to her? Why had he warned her to guard her son? Perhaps because he was their son. I reorganized my memories of Jofrin and the Fool. Close to 35 years ago, when the Fool found me dying in the mountains, he had taken me to his little home. He'd had a little mountain house that he shared with Jofrin. He had moved her out when he took me in. And when he had left to go with me on my quest, he had left everything he owned there for her. I thought of how she had reacted to me the last time we met. Could I interpret her ways toward me as the reaction of a lover who had been spurned for a friend? She had seemed to enjoy showing me that he had written to her while sending me no word. I reached back to those feverish days, remembering her voice, the adoring way she spoke of her white prophet. I had deemed it a sort of religious fervor. Perhaps it had been a different passion. But if she had borne him a child, surely he would have known for a certainty. He had sent her messages. Had she ever replied to them? If he'd left a child there, the boy would be a year younger than Nettle. Surely not a child that needed my protection. And the grandson who had been there had looked nothing like the Fool. Surely if he were the Fool's grandson, his white heritage would have shown somewhere. The Fool's grandson. For a long moment, those words seemed impossible to fit together. I pondered it as the flames ate her bones. The messenger's words made little sense. If the Fool had fathered a child the last time he'd been in Buckkeep, his son would be a young man, not a little boy. It didn't make sense. The messenger had called him a boy. I recalled how slowly the Fool had grown, how he had claimed to be decades older than I was. There was so much I didn't know, but if it was the way of his kind to age slowly, perhaps the son he had left behind still appeared to be a child. Then it could not be Jofron's son who had fathered a boy of his own. Had he sent her a warning because he feared the hunters would pursue any child who might remotely be the Fool's son? My mind ran in circles, trying to build a tower with too few blocks. Surely, if it was Jofron's son, he could have told me, with dozens of clues that only I would recognize. Call him the Toymaker's son, and I'd know him. But surely that was true of any son? The gardener's boy, the huntswoman's child. We'd known each other so well. Any child he'd left, surely he could have identified to me. If the Fool knew for sure where the child was he sending me on a wild goose chase to find a child reputed to exist on the basis of some obscure white prophecies? He wouldn't do that to me. No, almost certainly he would. Because he could believe that I could find such a child. Was it even the Fool's son? I sifted the messenger's meager words again. An unexpected son. Once, he had told me, those words referred to me. And now? Was there another unexpected son somewhere? Could I be certain this boy was the Fool's son? Her knowledge of my language had been less than perfect.
Papa?
Bee's voice was shaking, and when I turned to her, I saw that she had wrapped her arms around herself and was shivering with cold.
Have we finished?
Her nose was red at the tip. I looked at our fire. The last load of branches I had put on it collapsed suddenly. How much would be left of the girl? The skull, the heavier thigh bones, the column of spine. I stepped forward to peer into the heart of the fire. They were covered with ember and ash. Tomorrow, I'd bring the bedding from the nurse's bed in the room adjacent to B's and burn it here. Tonight, it was enough. I hoped. I looked around us. There was a moon, but layers of clouds veiled it. An icy mist hung over the low and boggy pasture lands. What moonlight reached the ground there was claimed by the fog. Let's go back in. I held out a hand to her. She looked at it, and then reached up to put her small fingers in mine. They were cold. Impulsively, I scooped her up. She pushed against me.
I'm 9, not 3.
I released her and she slid to the ground. I know that, I said apologetically. You just look so cold.
I am cold. Let's get back inside.
I didn't try to touch her again, but contented myself that she walked along beside me. I thought of the morrow and felt heavy with dread. It would be complicated enough without dealing with Shun and Riddle also. I dreaded that I must falsely report an infestation, for I knew the scurrying and scrubbing that would follow. Revel would be beside himself. The entire staff would be chastised. The laundering would be endless. I thought of my own room and winced. I'd have to subject myself to an invasion of housekeepers, or my accusations would ring false. And I did not want even to imagine Shun's outrage and disgust at the idea that her bedding might harbor vermin. Well, there was no help for it. My excuse for burning B's bedding in the middle of the night must be convincing. No avoiding the lies I must tell. Just as there had been no way to avoid exposing B to all this cascading debris from my old life, I shook my head at how poorly I had protected her. All I wanted to do right now was to be alone and try to think through what it all meant. The thought that the fool had reached out to me after all these years was overwhelming. I tried to sort the emotions I was feeling and was startled to find that anger was one of them. All those years with no word from him and no way for me to reach out to him. And then, when he needed something, this imperious and life-disrupting intrusion. Frustration vied with a terrible desire to see him after all these years. The message seemed to indicate that he was in danger, restrained from traveling or spied upon. Injured somehow? When last I had seen him, he had been so anxious to return to his old school, to share with them the end of the pale woman and all he had learned during his long travels. To Clarez. I knew no more of that place than its name. Had he come into conflict with the school? Why? What had become of the black man, his traveling companion, and a fellow white prophet? The messenger had made no mistake of Prilcop at all. The fool had always loved riddles and puzzles, and loved his privacy even more. But this did not feel like one of his pranks. It felt more as if he had sent every bit of information he dared, inadequate as it was, and hoped that I would have the resources to find whatever else I needed to know. Did I? Was I still the person he hoped I was? The strange part was that I actually hoped I wasn't. I'd been a sly, resourceful assassin, capable of spying, running, fighting, and killing. I didn't want to do that anymore. I could still feel the warmth of the girl's skin under my thumbs, feel the feebling grip of her hands on my wrists as her struggling gave way to unconsciousness, and then death. I'd made it quick for her, not painless, for no death is without pain. But I'd made the pain much briefer than it otherwise would have been. I'd granted her mercy. And I'd once more felt that surge of power one gets when one kills. The thing that Shade and I never discussed with anyone, not even each other. The nasty little burst of supremacy that I continued to live when someone else had died. I never wanted to feel that again. Truly, I didn't. Nor did I want to wonder at how quickly I had decided to grant her the mercy of a swift death. For decades now, I had insisted that I did not want to be an assassin. Tonight, I doubted my sincerity.
Papa,
An assassin flinched and turned his scrutiny on the small girl. For a moment, I didn't recognize her. I struggled to find my way back to being her father. "Molly," I said, the word bursting from me aloud, making Bee's face grow pale so that her reddened cheeks and nose stood out as if splashed with blood. Molly had kept me safe. She had been the waymarker on a different path my life could take. Now she was gone, and I felt as if I had fallen over a cliff's edge and was hopelessly plunging toward ruin, and I had pulled my child over with me.
"She's dead,"
Bee said in a small voice, and suddenly it was real all over again. "I know," I said miserably. She reached up and took my hand.
"You were leading us off into the dark and the fog, toward the pasture. Come this way."
She tugged my hand, and I realized I had been walking toward a misty, forested strip of land beside the pasture. She turned us back toward Withywoods, where light shone dim in a few windows. My child guided me home. We moved silently through the darkened corridors of Withywoods, across the flagged entrance, up the curved staircase, and along the hallway we softly paced. I paused at the entrance to her room and abruptly recalled that she could not sleep there. I looked at her and hated myself. Her nose was a bright red button. She wore a winter cloak and boots, and under that, only a woolen nightdress. It was now soaked to the knee. "Oh, Bee. Let's get you a clean nightgown. Then you'll sleep in my room tonight." I winced at the thought, recalling the boar's nest that my room had become. No help for it now. I wanted every scrap of bedding in her room destroyed to avoid contagion from whatever horrid creatures the messenger had carried within her. I suppressed a shudder at the thought of the vicious judgment passed on her. So irrevocable. So their punishment for being a traitor was lingering and painful death, one that no apology or explanation would halt. I was still not sure who they were, but already I despised them. I kindled a candle at her hearth while Bee went to her clothing chest. Her nightgown dragged a wet trail on the floor. She lifted the heavy lid, wedged a shoulder under it to open, and began to rummage through the contents. I glanced around the room. The stripped bed looked stark and accusing. I'd killed a woman in this room tonight. Did I ever want my child to sleep here again? She might not be haunted by what I'd done, for surely she had no idea of it. She would believe the messenger had just died of her wounds. But this killing would bother me for a long time. I didn't want my daughter sleeping in the bed where I'd killed someone. Tomorrow, I'd broach the idea of moving her into a new room. For tonight...
"Stop! Just please stop! Leave me alone! Please!"
It was Shun's voice rising to a shriek on the last word. "Stay here," I barked at Bee and left the room. Shun's temporary chamber was at the end of the corridor. I was only a few steps down the hall before Riddle, in his nightshirt, knife in hand, and his hair standing up in wild tufts, burst out of his room and into the corridor. Shoulder to shoulder we ran. Shun's voice rose again, ascending in terror.
"I'm sorry you're dead. It wasn't my fault. It wasn't my fault. Leave me alone."
The door to her bedchamber was abruptly flung open, and a wailing Shun sprang into the dim hall. Her auburn hair was loose about the shoulders of her nightgown. She had a knife in one hand, a fine and slender blade, and even in her terror, she carried it as if she would know how to use it. She shrieked louder at the sight of us running toward her. Then she recognized Riddle and, breathlessly shouting his name, ran into his arms, narrowly missing the knife he carried. She seemed not to notice when he caught her wrist and with a pinch made her drop her own blade. "What is it? What's wrong?" We were both shouting, and in response she only wailed and hugged Riddle's neck so tightly that I thought she would choke him. She had buried her face in his chest, and he held his knife well clear of her in one hand while he awkwardly patted her back with the other. She was saying something over and over, but I could not understand her. I stooped and picked up her blade. I recognized the design as one favored for assassin work. Evidently, she had not felt her rudimentary training would protect her against a ghost. I tucked it away in my sleeve. "I'll check her room. Keep her safe," I said to Riddle. But as I moved past them, she suddenly lifted her head and shrieked, "Don't go in there! Don't go in there! It's his ghost, crying and crying! He blames me! Ronno blames me!" I halted, feeling a sick fear spread through me. I am not a superstitious man. I do not believe in ghosts. Yet I almost heard the distant wailing of a lost child. My heart sank, and I welcomed Riddle's words as he said to her, "It was only a bad dream, Shun. You've been through a lot, and you've carried a lot of fear this past fortnight. Here you are, in an unfamiliar house, wondering what shape your life is about to take. It's only to be expected that you'd have a bad dream." She pushed away from him violently. Her voice was indignant. "It wasn't a bad dream. I wasn't able to fall asleep. I was lying in bed, thinking, and I began to hear the wailing. It's Ronno. The little wretch was always crying, always whining and begging. Anything sweet or delicious that was cooked for me, he wanted some of it. And even when he was told it was for me, he would keep begging, or he would just steal some of it. And that's what got him killed." She was suddenly angry instead of frightened. "He stole from me and ate it, and he died. How can that be my fault?" "It wasn't," Riddle immediately replied. "Of course it wasn't. The blame falls on whoever was trying to poison you." Her sobs changed suddenly, and I wondered how I knew she had gone from terrified to comforted. Her face was buried in his shoulder, and she clung to him, her arms wrapped around his neck and her body pressed close to him. He sent me an uncomfortable look over her shoulder. I tried not to scowl. I was not sure what he and Nettle were to each other, but even in this context, I did not like seeing him hold another woman. "I'll check her room, just to be sure there's nothing amiss," I told him. She lifted her face. Tears and snot had dismissed any beauty from her face. "I was not dreaming, as I was not asleep. Nor did I imagine it. I heard his crying." "I'll see to it." As I walked past Riddle, he passed his knife to me. He quirked one eyebrow in an abbreviated shrug. It was always better to be armed than not in any situation. "I'll put her in my room for the night," he offered.
"You cannot leave me alone," she wailed.
There was deep resignation in his voice as he offered, "I'll sleep across your threshold, just outside your door. If anything bothers you, I'll be only steps away." I was already moving down the hall and did not hear the words of her choked objection. I halted outside the door of her chamber and settled myself. It could be anything or nothing, I reminded myself. I pulled the door open and looked into the room. I unfurled my wit sense, reaching out to investigate the room. Nothing. I sensed no human or animal within the chamber. It was not an absolute assurance that Shun had imagined an intruder, but it was reassuring to me. Firelight from the low-burning hearth coated the room in honey. The bedding had spilled from the bed and trailed her to the door. I moved inside, stepping softly and listening. What had she heard? For I suspected there would be a grain of truth at least in her complaint. Had the wind whistled through the chimney or past her window? But all was silent, save for the muted crackling of the fire. I lit a branch of candles and explored the room with them, checking behind curtains and under the bed and even in the still, empty clothing chests. They had been freshly cleaned and held only new sachets. They smelled of cedar and lavender and waited to be used. Shun had not unpacked, so much as avalanched into the room. Clothing was everywhere, cascading from her baggage, draped across the foot of the bed and on top of the clothing chests, I scowled at her untidiness. Well, by tomorrow, her maid would be here to set her to rights. Still, it did not please me that a girl of her age did not even know how to be orderly in her unpacking. Her jewelry was scattered across the top of the small vanity next to a bag of pink and yellow sweets. Shade had obviously opened his purse for her, and she had taken full advantage of it. What sort of training had he given the girl? She clearly thought much of herself, but no trace of discipline or order did I find in her behavior. How had he looked at her and considered her a candidate to be a spy, let alone an assassin? I wondered where he had found her and why she mattered so much to him. He'd hidden her pedigree well, but I was determined to know it now. I'd sniff out his secrets in my spare time, when I was not looking for the fool's misplaced heir, or accusing my servants of vermin in the bedding, or repairing the damage I'd done to my daughter. I had not been managing my old life very well. I could not imagine coping with Shun in addition. I finished my search carefully, checking that the windows and shutters were tightly closed, and that her maid's adjoining room was innocent of all intruders. There was nothing there. I retreated from her chamber, trying to set my concerns about Shun aside for tonight. Tonight, I would take care of my immediate worries. Tomorrow would be time enough to think about adapting Shun to our simpler habits. Tomorrow. We were well past midnight. Today. I took the lit candles with me and went down the hall to where Riddle stood in his nightshirt, his arms crossed on his chest. I had never seen the man look so stubborn. A rumpled kitchen maid, one of the village girls newly hired to help, stood nearby in her nightrobe and shawl, looking both sleepy and alarmed. Mild stood nearby, disapproval at this uproar stamped on her face. And Shun was complaining loudly. Mentally, I was thankful that Revel had not been roused. Tomorrow would be soon enough to put the house steward in an uproar. Shun set her hands to her hips and glared at Riddle. Her dark, curling hair was wild on her shoulders, and her nightdress strained against her out-thrust chest.
No, I don't want her sleeping beside me. And what could she do if the ghost came back? Riddle, you are supposed to protect me. I want you to sleep in my room.
Lady Shun, that would not be appropriate,
Riddle replied firmly. I had the feeling he was repeating himself.
You wanted a companion for the night? Here is Pansy, ready to serve, and I assure both of you that I'll be right here, stretched across the threshold, should you need any sort of assistance.
Ghost?
Pansy broke in, her sleepiness vanishing. She turned her shock and appeal on Riddle.
Sir, I beg you, the lady is right. I would be useless should a ghost come into the room. I'm certain I should faint dead away.
I checked Lady Shun's room. I assure you there is no intruder and nothing to fear there, I announced firmly.
Of course there isn't now,
Shun objected.
It was Rono's little ghost crying and accusing me. Ghosts cannot be found when you search for them. They come and go as they please.
Rono?
Mild laughed and then said,
Oh, beg pardon, Lady Shun, but there is no Rono ghost in that room. The only ghost known to walk through those chambers is old Lord Pike, so his parents named him, but all the maidservants in the manor call him Old Lord Peak, for he dearly loves to catch a glimpse of any woman in her shift or drawers. My own mother told me that he would hide in the...
No more stories tonight, I announced firmly. I already knew from the look on Pansy's face that she would be giving her notice tomorrow. The suppressed amusement in Riddle's eyes could not lighten my mood. All I wanted was to seek my own bed. I put authority into my voice. Mild, if you would, help Riddle to make up a pallet outside Lady Shun's door. Lady Shun, if you wish a companion to share this chamber with you, then we are offering you Pansy. No one else. Pansy, you will be paid extra for this service tonight. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is all. I am going to my own bed now. There have been enough disruptions after a very taxing day.
If Rono's ghost
throttles me in the night in vengeance for his death, I hope you will have a good explanation for Lord Shade as to how you failed in your duty to protect me."
She threw the stony words at my back. I continued to walk away. I knew I was leaving the burden of sorting it out on Riddle's shoulders. I knew he could handle it. And he'd had at least some sleep, and had not murdered anyone, nor burned a body tonight. I opened the door to B's chamber. Empty. So she'd had the sense to change her clothing and go to my room. I continued down the corridor. I opened the door to my room and stood still. I could feel that she wasn't there. The room gave me no wit sense of her presence, only chill and emptiness. The fire had almost burned out. I lifted my branch of candles high, trying to tell if she had been here. So far as I could tell, nothing had changed since I'd last left the room. Habit made me cross to the hearth and add wood to the fire. "Bee," I called softly. "Are you hiding in here?" I dragged the rucked blankets off the bed to be sure she hadn't burrowed in and fallen asleep. The ridged sheets and stink of sweaty mail assured me that she would have found it an unappealing hiding spot. No, she had not been here. I headed back to her room. All was quiet in the corridor. Riddle opened his eyes and lifted his head as I passed. "Just checking on B," I told him. I was reluctant to let him know that I'd misplaced my own daughter. Just the thought of what he would report back to Nettle about the disorder in my household made me wince. Ghosts and smoking chimneys and a half-trained staff were as nothing compared with misplacing Nettle's small sister. Candles held high, I entered her room. "Bee," I called softly. Obviously not on the bared bedstead. I knew a moment of fear. Had she crept into the bedding in the servants' room? I hated myself that I had not taken it and burned it immediately. "Bee?" I cried louder, and two hasty strides carried me to the door of the adjoining chamber. Empty. I tried to remember how it had looked when I had last seen it. Had not the bedding been less on the floor and more on the bedstead? I prayed to gods I scarcely acknowledged that she had not touched it. The room was so small that it was the work of a moment to be sure she wasn't in it. I stepped out of it and then, horror-stricken, rushed to her winter clothing chest. How often had I reminded myself that she needed something smaller with a lighter lid? I knew she had fallen into it, her head smashed, and then suffocated in the dark. But all it held was her clothing in pushed heaps and wads. Relief warred with worry. She wasn't there. I felt a spasm of annoyance that her clothing was so ill-kept. Had the servants abandoned this room when I chased them from mine? In so many ways, I was failing my child, but most of all, in that I had lost her tonight. My foot nudged something, and I looked down at a heap of wet clothing on the floor. B's clothes. So she had changed here. She'd been here, and now she was gone. Where could she be? Where would she go? The kitchen? Had she been hungry? No, she'd been unsettled, even scared. So where would she go? And I knew. I walked past Riddle, feigning a calm I didn't feel. "Good night," I wished him wryly. He watched me pass and then rolled to his feet in a fluid motion. "I'll help you look for her." I hated his perspicacity and welcomed it. "You take the kitchens, then. I'll check my study." He nodded and was off at a trot. Shielding my candle flames, I followed. At the bottom of the stair, we went our separate ways. I doubled back to go to my private study. All was quiet and dark as I traversed the dark passageways. When I reached the double doors of the study, they were closed. All was still. Chapter 18. Invisibility.